Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 75. On this episode of the podcast, we are going to be talking about The Martian, which is a great kickoff to the fall and award season films that we'll be reviewing and talking about, and hopefully that you guys will be seeing. It has a great cast, including Matt Damon and Jessica Chastain, Kate Mara, Jeff Daniels, and I mean so many more. It's just an incredible ensemble of a cast, directed by Ridley Scott. It's based on the incredibly popular book by Andy Weir, so it had a lot of things going for it, and we all kind of enjoyed it. We had a great, fun discussion about the movie. Joining me, I think this is even one of the best parts. I have two guys that I haven't had have on the show for a while, so we get to catch up with them. That's Elijah Lovejoy, the executive pastor at Church of the Redeemer here in Greensboro, and Wade Bearden, who lots of you know from the Seeing and Believing podcast over at Christ and Pop Culture. So, like I said, we have a fun time catching up with those guys, trying to figure out the last time they were on the show, which was far too long. But we want to make sure that you can get a hold of those guys. And so go to Real World Theology's website, which is www.realworldtheology.com. You can find the show notes for this episode, for other episodes, find the other stuff that Elijah and Wade have done. You'll also find new reviews, top five lists, like I said, all the other podcasts, streaming recommendations, all kinds of stuff that we're putting out there for you guys who just love film and love engaging with it. So follow us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. We'll give you the real updates of anytime we have new episodes, new posts. You can find us on Twitter at Real World Theo. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast. It always helps to have more subscribers, more reviewers. You can look for new episodes of the podcast near the 1st, 10th, 20th, and the 20th of the month. You can, again, find us on Feedburner, Stitcher, iTunes. And something to be looking forward to is that, like I said, this is the fall season. This is the award season. We're going to be doing so many, hopefully, great reviews for you guys on what looks to be like an incredible slate of movies, including Pan, Crimson Peak, Steve Jobs, Spectre, The Good Dinosaur. And we have something hopefully very special that you guys are going to enjoy, kicking off some mini-sodes for our special Star Wars preparation for The Force Awakens. So, rate and review the show. Tell your friends. Let's get more people involved in the conversation. And like I said, this was a really good one with two great guests talking about a really cool movie. Here it is, episode 75, The Martian and Earthly Optimism. Movie theaters are modern day pulpits. Real World Theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
I mean, that's why I feel, I don't know, I really wanted to get you on, because trying to incorporate all this new stuff, we have a lot of new writers, and I was like, God, I just haven't talked to Wade in a long time.
It's been a while, I think.
Well, I mean,
it's been
like January, February, yeah.
Yeah, I think American Sniper. So, yeah, January. Yeah,
that's the last one I was on, too.
Yeah, and that's the last one Elijah was on, because Elijah went on his, like, I don't watch movies thing, and then wrote his book, and then, you know, then I asked, I think in the middle of the summer, I asked Elijah, like, what he was interested in, and he was like, nothing. or he's like, one or two films, and I think one of them I wasn't going to do, and I was like, dang it, I really want to get Elijah back on, because I just always enjoy, you know, Elijah, you push me. Wade, you're always fun to talk to. It's just, anyway, I just like having you guys on. So, Wade, what have you been up to? Like, like I said, has it been six, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September? What month is it? October? 8 months.
Yeah.
Eight months.
Has it been 8 months since we did American Sniper?
8 months since you guys have been on.
That's unbelievable.
That's crazy, because I think that was episode, it was like, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it's somewhere like in the late 40s, because it was before 50, I believe, because it was before Selma. Selma was our 50th episode.
Oh,
so
wow.
Think about it, we're recording episode 78 right now.
Wow. Yeah, you know? Man, I've been busy as well, but it's been good. I was a youth pastor. And it was I was doing a lot there. I was working a lot during the week, and it wasn't volunteer. It wasn't a high paying job or anything. Mm-hmm. And so I stepped down from that in July, which has been great for for our family right now to just kind of take a break. And so that's been good. But other than that, you know, just doing the podcast once a week has been it's been so much fun. And then just writing whenever I can. And so trying to publish whenever I can. And it's been good. So I think just doing that and then just trying to enjoy my son growing up. And and so that's kind of been where I'm at right now. And then I work for this group that helps pastors out with content and design work. And so that's my full-time job. And that's been going really great. It's been a lot of fun. And I've been able to travel a little bit. So it's been good. I can't complain.
Well, that's awesome. So it sounds kind of like you're in a very similar thing. You got plenty to do, but not really a whole lot of complaints about it, right?
Yeah, no. It's I like to stay busy. I like to stay busy. And so it's been good. I just trying to enjoy the time that I have right now. And so it's been a fun year.
Well, Elijah.
Yes.
I know, I ask you this probably knowing, I would assume knowing about 75% of what you've been up to, but what have you been up to since it's been so long? Because I know, like I said, you have legions of adoring fans out there in real world theology land. They're wondering, where has Elijah been?
Now, what I'm wondering in the back of my mind is this where the phrase, you don't know the half of it, came from? Or is it actually, you don't know the 75% of it?
Yeah, I don't know the quarter of it.
You don't know the quarter of
it. At least.
Yeah, I'm going to coin a new phrase tonight. What have I been up to? I did take about a month off this summer to work on writing a new book. Mm-hmm. Got a rough manuscript in place, about 19 chapters, 100 pages. Chapters are pretty short, 2 to 3 pages. And so that's been fun. It's a book on death and resurrection, viewed as the cycle or the rhythm of the Christian life. Mm-hmm. So really enjoyed doing that. Spent 6 years thinking, daydreaming, studying about that. So to be able to sit down after 6 years and have a month to write was a great gift from my church, my boss that I work for. What else?
You mean God, right?
God.
Yes. Yes.
Work for God as well as Church of the Redeemer. Teaching a class on systematic theology right now with the Greensboro Fellows Program. Having a good time doing that. Enjoying being a dad, 3 kids, 1 wife. Not to be confused with 1 kid or 3 wives.
Well, I can say in this day and age, there might be a question.
There could be a
especially
question.
Especially if you were a pro sports athlete.
Yes, but it's not a triplet or a whatever the quiplet is. It's 1 wife, 3 kids. And just having a good time, getting ready for fall. I run an outdoor ice rink in downtown Greensboro as well. And so I've been gearing up for that, doing that this November 17th is our kickoff day for that.
Cool. Oh. So I know at one point, Elijah, you didn't get to the theater very much, which is uncharacteristic. And then you kind of hop back in. Have you seen, not quite where we're, pretending like we're not quite here for The Martian yet. Like, up to this point, have you really seen anything that you enjoyed since kind of jumping back in?
Yeah, I really liked Phoenix, kind of an independent sleeper film. It's only shown at 1 theater here, but great movie. Very well done. One of the best surprise endings I think I've ever seen. Ant-Man was good, like that. Really like Sicario. I was a big fan of that. So yeah, there's several that I've seen that got my gears turned, and I think I was on a movie fast partly because of the quality of the movies they're out this summer.
Yeah, completely understandable at one point.
Yeah, but also just every now and then I can get so into movies that sometimes I'll just kind of take a month or two to not watch movies just to kind of help me focus on something else that I want to focus on for a while, and then I usually jump back in.
What's that like?
Not seeing a movie for a month or 2 months.
So
it's called free time.
Yeah. So let's take that and turn it around. And I'll ask you, Wade. So we're obviously here to talk about The Martian. The Martian kind of is almost like a flag planted in the fall movie season that says, "Look, from here on out,
It better be good.
You're probably going to get something good. And if you don't, it's going to disappoint a lot of people.
Yeah.
So kind of from this flag forward, not including this flag, because like I said, we'll have a chance to obviously talk about this flag. Wade, what are you probably most looking forward to come into the year?
Yeah, I mean, I think the easy answer, and I mean, it's definitely pertains to me, is Star Wars, right? Mm-hmm. Force Awakens. I'm really looking forward to that. Big Star Wars fan. Hateful Eight's coming out. I'm actually really excited about Steve Jobs, the new Steve Jobs movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have a chance to see that Monday, so I'm pumped.
Oh, show off.
Tomorrow, guys, I get to see Bridge of Spies, and I'm a huge Spielberg fan, and
good.
They're doing this screening thing where they're going to show us a live Q&A with Spielberg and Tom Hanks, so it's going to be awesome. I'm like just so pumped. So that's happening tomorrow. So there's some great stuff.
What's airfare to your place?
Yeah. I'm really excited about I Saw the Light, the Hank Williams Sr., biopic. I don't really know if it's going to be good or bad. I haven't even seen a trailer yet, but I think
the reviews are terrible.
Oh, they are.
I don't want to crap on it. I mean, like, because I want to like Tom Hiddleston in anything, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's reviewing pretty poorly.
Well, that's sad. Sicario was good.
Mm-hmm.
Spectre looks fun. I'm actually really excited too about Mockingjay Part 2. I think that could be good. So there's really a lot of movies that I'm excited about. Crimson Peak is coming out. So
I think you're just listening to everything that way. I think you're cheating.
I'm just listening. Yeah, I'm listening.
Listening everything.
Did you see Slow West, Wade?
I did. It was great.
I liked that a lot.
Gosh.
Yeah. Very good. It's all Phoenix too. Yeah, yeah. I like it too.
All sitting downstairs in my queue. Gosh.
Mm-hmm. Check that one.
So, have you really looked ahead yet, Elijah, to see what's kind of coming out for the rest of this kind of movie season? Pre-award season?
No, I'm not. I'm kind of living the moment. Carpe diem. Too much.
Carpe film.
Carpe filmum.
Yeah.
So I don't know nearly as much as you guys. I mean, I'm familiar with the titles you listed, and I check the previews, or I check the trailers that come out usually once a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't list them off the top of my head.
That's incredible restraint.
Yeah.
That's incredible restraint.
What's that?
Yeah.
Only checking the preview or the trailers out like once a week.
Once a week. Maybe twice a week.
Mm-hmm. I actually haven't been watching a lot of trailers if I can help it. Just because, man, trailers spoil so much now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't seek out a lot of trailers.
Mm-mm.
Sometimes I'll watch maybe the teaser trailer. But there have been movies that I've gone to go see, and I haven't watched the trailer at all. And it's been actually very, very nice.
Well, I think
you come in not really knowing much.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we've kind of probably on and off different episodes kind of had some trailer talk.
Yeah.
And I do not make a secret of the fact that I don't mind trailers, but I really only need enough trailer until I know I'm going to go see the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And once I'm going to go see the movie, I don't need anything else.
You don't finish watching the trailer.
Well, I mean, I guess if it's that good, then I don't need to. But usually I watch, like probably usually the teaser. Usually the teaser is enough for me.
Hmm.
If the teaser, like the Star Wars teaser, I mean, I was going to see Star Wars anyway, but the Star Wars teaser was so good. Like, that's all I needed. I don't need anything. Like, they can just show the teaser, that little 1 minute thing on a rotation for 220 times, and I'd probably go see it. That's how I was actually really upset recently because, I saw the teaser for The Revenant.
That looks good too.
Inarritu's new film. Yeah, and I was like, okay, Inarritu's doing this. Tom Hardy, Leo Caprio. It's, the 1 minute teaser. It's all I needed. And I was doing, Real World, Mark was kind of like, oh my gosh. Have you seen the new Revenant trailer? Like trailer two, you've got to watch. Mm-hmm. It's so good. I was like, dude, I don't want to know anything else about the movie. And so I avoided it. And I think before The Martian, they showed the new trailer.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, they just showed everything that happened in the movie or that is going to happen in the movie. And it was, I was not physically angry, but I was really disappointed.
Wasn't this the guy that did Birdman? Mm-hmm. Like, what a completely different movie than Birdman this looks like.
It does, like, not stylistically necessarily, because it still looks beautiful. Mm-hmm. It still looks like he knows, like he's got a master of every, like everything he's doing looks like he's doing it intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
But different subject matter, mm-hmm. you know, completely different, like in the wild.
Different intensity, different genre, different mm-hmm. time period. Some
and
versatility.
I'm going to say, I don't want to call it a gimmick, because it's more than a gimmick. It's the thing I've read so far is that kind of like the continuous scenes in Birdman, the thing about The Revenant is like only natural light being used, which is a really big deal in actual Hollywood production. You know, they bring in like artificial light everywhere, and it's mm-hmm. all natural, and like these shots are, it just, I mean, it's probably why it looks incredibly beautiful mm-hmm. And so like rustic. But I would already be placing bets on, you know, I was like, Inarritu, go ahead and give him the award for best director, you know, cinematography.
Two of my favorite male actors, Tom Hardy
mm-hmm. and Caprio. So I just, anyway, I'm just so excited about that. I mean, I want to be as excited for like The Hateful Eight and, you know, things like The Good Dinosaur and Spectre and stuff like that. But honestly, I just can't wait to see The Revenant. I'm mm-hmm. just so excited.
Yeah, it definitely looks good. And I like Birdman. I didn't think that it was the best film of last year. But
Hear.
And, you know, not a
grumble.
Of Babel or like 21 Grams. But his films are always interesting. So mm-hmm. I'm going to go see it, definitely.
Well, I think we had this conversation too, because I think you were one of the people who thought like Boyhood was like the cream of the crop.
Yeah, no, I thought it was the best film.
Yeah, and it would barely make my top 10. But then again, you know, you're an Astros fan, so you have a lot to cheer for right now, right?
I've got a lot to cheer for. I think Boyhood featuring the Houston Astros in the film, it really inspired the team.
You
know, people are looking at us now, and people know who we are, and so it's been great. It's been good.
That's really how they probably should advertise it. You know, like Boyhood featuring the Houston Astros.
Yeah. Oh man.
Well, so we've planted the flag, or I've kind of used this metaphor of planting the flag, and we planted it right here at the beginning of October / last week of September, because, I mean, Sicario, I haven't seen it yet. Both of you guys have, and both of you have told me very positive things about it. Almost anyone who I know who has seen it has told me very positive things about it, and so that kind of slips in there, and to a certain degree, Everest, that last week of September. But right here, first week of October, for the past 2-3 years at least, this is where award fodder starts. This is when, if you think your movie is going to be the stuff, it's going to be nominated for Best Picture or something like that, you start releasing it right now if you have a lot of confidence. And basically first on the docket is The Martian. And The Martian itself has this like ridiculous cast. We just reviewed Black Mass and talked about how it had this incredible ensemble of people. And I think The Martian, or I might have mentioned that The Martian was one of the only movies coming out for the rest of the year that has a cast or an ensemble that can probably match it or best it. And mm-hmm. in that, we have Matt Damon, Jessica Chastain, Kate Mara, Michael Pena, Sebastian Stan, Jeff Daniels, Kristen Wiig, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Donald Glover, Sean Bean, who doesn't die, spoilers. That's a big deal. You know, so we have just this incredible cast. So many people that you don't even get enough screen time with lots of these characters that you'd like. And then you throw in the fact that it's directed by Ridley Scott, one of the most prominent, arguably best sci-fi directors in history, and written by Drew Goddard, who's written a whole bunch of really great stuff. Cabin in the Woods, was a writer for Buffy, Lost, things like that. Based on a book that has been incredibly popular and incredibly loved. Mm-hmm. So it seems like this has everything going for it. So at this point, the reviews are almost overwhelmingly positive. I want to say it's sitting at like 90% or so.
93, 94.
Yeah, there you go. So mm-hmm. it's, I mean, which is a feat in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Getting above 90% on Rotten Tomatoes with many people that want to make a name by lambasting a film that people like, it's impressive to be there. But
265 reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. I just read through about half of them.
And you don't, and you still wanted to like not shoot yourself.
And I still wanted to not shoot myself. Yeah.
I mean, that in and of itself is a feat. So with what has basically come to be our yearly space film, Wade, we'll start with you, because you're on Skype. like I said, we have the Skype rule. In your opinion, or in your factual knowledge,
okay,
how does The Martian kind of set itself apart from our previous space films like Gravity and Interstellar? And whatever those differences are, mm-hmm. did they kind of resonate with you? Did you like it?
So I think that you can compare The Martian to a film like Gravity. You could compare it to a film like Apollo 13 mm-hmm. with astronauts that are trying to get home and they have to be very resourceful. And then to, you know, Interstellar. I think with those films...
That was almost an afterthought.
Yeah, you know. with those films, there's very much this idea of human existence, pondering human existence and what is life really about, and thinking and kind of mulling over these big questions of humanity. With mm-hmm. The Martian, it's takes a different turn, right?
Yeah.
You don't really have Mark Watney sitting around wondering what the purpose of humanity is, or wondering if he is a representation of planet Earth, or you know, whatever. And it's just very much this positive, optimistic film, and it doesn't try to be anything other than that. And I think that for me that works great. I like Gravity. I liked Interstellar. I like Apollo 13. But this one, it sets itself apart as a film that is trying to be kind of the everyman's film from space. And you have Matt Damon, who is kind of this everyman actor. And it's interesting to note that he never really – he gets down a little bit throughout the
yeah.
film. But he never really becomes depressed, and he never – you know, just, oh, I want to give up. He's a scientist, and he says, mm-hmm. okay, I'm going to work through a process. Hey, let's do this. Let's work through this. And – it really says something, I think, about science. And as a film, I really liked it. I really enjoyed it. And I like the take here. I wouldn't say it's lighthearted, but it is optimistic. And I think that it excels in those areas.
No, I would completely agree. But Elijah, where did you kind of land rover thing, Martian landing? I don't know. I was trying to make a connection. It didn't work.
Yeah.
Just keep going.
I'll keep going. Yeah. I mean, one of the reviews that I tend to agree with said this was a survival epic and the scientific method was the hero, which I think kind of is a good synopsis of he tries one thing, it doesn't work, he tweaks it, and he tries something else.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, I felt like I was getting a tutorial on how to survive in space on Mars, kind of. One reviewer called it a do-it-yourself guide for how to survive on Mars. So in that sense, I would agree with Wade that it was optimistic. I would even use the word celebratory. It was celebrating kind of the triumph of science, the triumph mm-hmm. of the human will, of not giving up, of creativity, ingenuity. I loved watching the audience in the theater with me. Mm-hmm. I went on a Thursday night. And no, it was a Friday. It was a Friday early afternoon matinee. Pretty full theater, a lot of older folks there. Mm-hmm. And I would describe the audience as attentive and respectful, but not boisterous.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they were watching with attentive and intrigued respect, but it wasn't like this gusto kind of that you would experience maybe in another movie. If I have a critique or something I didn't care for about it, it felt too simplistic to me. It mm-hmm. felt too easy to me. And I would contrast that to Interstellar, where it's like,
yeah.
oh my goodness, my mind's bending. Like Christopher Nolan's always going to bend your mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
My mind's bending and I can't figure this out. I don't know how this is going to go. And then this kind of mind-blowing ending, 4D space or 5D, five-dimensional time.
We're still trying to figure out.
We're still trying to figure it out. Yeah. But this is like... I mean, he summarized it in the end. You solve one problem, you move on to the next. And if you solve enough problems, you get to live. Like,
yeah.
Interesting theory, but something feels missing in that to me.
Well, it's really interesting that you would have this feeling of simplicity from it. And I'm not necessarily trying to defend the film,
mm-hmm.
but it was actually criticized, or the book was criticized especially, even though most people still enjoyed the book, that the book itself was too full of scientific mumbo jumbo that people didn't understand. And there were even concerns that when it was made into the film, that Watney's explanation of things would be over people's heads and it would not, like, it wouldn't be simple enough. And considering, like, that, unlike Interstellar, where we're using kind of theoretical physics and just theoretical theories. I mean, like, we're not really using anything that we have necessarily grounded in science at some point in Interstellar.
Right.
Whereas basically everything we get in The Martian is based on actual science.
Right.
NASA, you know, being brought in to say, look, this is basically what we're getting ready to do.
Yeah.
Like, this is our 2020 plan. We want to, like, this is what the rovers would look like. This is what the housing would look like. This is what we would be expecting to collect when we go.
Yeah.
You know, this is what the suits would look like.
Right.
You know, just in kind of doing all this stuff that's actually, how did one review, I think I put it, or it was when they were talking to NASA or something, they said, it doesn't seem like it's in the future because it's really not that far in the future.
Right.
And it doesn't seem like it's that spectacular because it's a lot of what we already have.
Yeah.
And people just don't realize it.
If you look at this as a period piece, but a future period piece,
yeah,
like, this was the best future period piece I've seen. Way better than Interstellar, way better than Gravity. I mean, Gravity had these unique cinematography stuff going on that was kind of cool, but just, you could tell the level of research that they did, bringing in NASA to help shape the film. It gave it a grittiness and an authenticity that the level of detail. And they did a great job of communicating that. So when I say simplistic, I'm not so much talking about that it didn't have complex scientific experimentation like that going on. I'm more thinking simplistic in terms of
convenience of story.
The plot line felt fairly simplistic to me. Like, he's on Mars, he's stuck, he's got to get back. How's it going to happen? Let's work that out. And I would also add the subject material. I felt like Interstellar went into way deeper subject material in terms of the human psyche than this did. Like, he's trying to survive and he's fighting really hard. Go, Matt Damon kind of thing. And he did a great job, and you did resonate with him. So that's not a knock on him, but it felt like it could have gone way deeper than that. But it focused on the science, the intricacies of the science of it and surviving more so than it did. I guess the deepest thing was maybe interpersonal dynamics back in NASA. Like, the biggest philosophical statement that I heard is not about one person. Yes, it is. Okay. That's kind of getting a little deep, but they didn't pursue that at all.
Yeah.
It was a one-liner.
And that'll definitely, the things that they didn't really dive into, kind of like Wade, you were talking about, it's stuff that we can still talk about because there's an undercurrent in the film of, you know, interdependence and, you know, human ingenuity and the one being worth the sacrifice of the many, things like that. That I don't think they really tried to highlight, but is unavoidable. Whether you try to, you know, if Nolan would have done it, Nolan would have stopped and had Matt Damon like give like a 15-minute like monologue about how, you know, is it, you know, he would have done it in his Matthew McConaughey voice, even though he was Matt Damon, and been like, why am I here? I'm on Mars. Yeah, I'm the only one on Mars. I'm the lost sheep that's gone astray. You know.
Yeah, the film felt very natural. So there weren't any tacked on romantic plots, right? There wasn't.
Okay, there was.
Well, I mean, for Watney's character.
Okay, yeah.
Right? So they don't really give us much backstory. He's, you know, not in love and fighting, you know, to get back to this romantic interest or anything like that. And I found that simplicity just really beneficial in that it's a tale about survival. And I think that's how it differentiated between something like Castaway or some other, you know, Robinson Crusoe type story. Yeah. In that it's very simplistic. And it's a guy that I think many of us can relate to. If you're on Mars and you're stuck, but you have this incredible amount of ingenuity, you know, you're probably not going to be moping around a lot. You know, this character is someone who's He was funny, and he puts one foot in front of the other, right? He's like a mule. He keeps on going no matter what, just pushing forward. And to me, I thought that was way more fascinating. It was a very different take. It was a funny take, and it didn't try to be overtly philosophical, because mm-hmm. I think when a film really tries to do that too hard, mm-hmm. it can come up empty. And instead of trying to force anything, I thought that Ridley Scott and Goddard did a great job of just letting this story happen. And in the book, it's very much that same way. So it is very technical. And, you know, you watch the movie and there are all these obstacles in his way. In the book, there are many more. And it's almost redundant after a while. And so they cut that down, but they kept kind of the core of his character. And there's not much backstory in the book either. And I thought that really helped the film.
Yeah, I would say that the films that you mentioned that have to hit that philosophical depth, like if they choose to have it, that's their thing, and if they miss it, it ruins the entire film.
Mm-hmm. I'll say that about this movie. They knew the kind of movie that they wanted to make, and they made it.
And yeah,
they were not confused about what kind of mm-hmm. movie they wanted to make. So I think if you have clear vision and you execute well on that vision, I think you're gonna at least hit a double, and I think they at least hit a triple or a home run.
So, and that's kind of where I would say this film landed for me, because there's two big, almost metaphors or comparisons that I would make, and the first is that when you talk about recent films, especially like Gravity and Interstellar, I think this gave us more story than Gravity gave us, but it took itself less serious than Interstellar, which mm-hmm. was refreshing,
mm-hmm.
and to the point where I would compare it. How did I say it? I don't want to mess this up. The Martian is like Marvel, and Interstellar is like DC, mm-hmm. which is very apt because Interstellar, is Nolan, and DC to a great degree right now is still Nolan. And The Martian The Martian allowed its stakes to be serious. It allowed there to be consequences and things that needed to be strived for, but it allowed that to exist in a theme that was hopeful and optimistic, and they allowed themselves to laugh. But it didn't detract from the seriousness of the actual situation.
Which but I think, the fizz, no cities were destroyed.
Yeah, exactly.
See, the fate of humanity didn't rest in this one movie.
Well, I don't know if the fate... Anyway, I think you know where I'm going with that.
I mean, that's actually one question I have. Like, this movie resonated emotionally, and it was entertaining. But the question in the back of my mind is why?
Well, so that leads basically to the second comparison that I would have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like after watching DC, you know, mm-hmm. like the Batman films.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would consider at least a 50%, if not more, failed Man of Steel film.
Mm-hmm.
And even some heavier Marvel films, like with some themes that Iron Man brings up,
mm-hmm.
You know, with just like the struggling against his old self, things like that. It's like finally getting a Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you write a character that's good and hopeful and optimistic and it doesn't seem cheesy and we dismiss it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's The Martian.
Mm-hmm.
The Martian is the film that is hopeful and optimistic and has a little tongue in cheek, mm-hmm. has some laughter, and somehow we don't go, oh goodness, this is so dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is just like, it's too silly to like, we connect with it. We want a happy ending most of the time. And you could argue that maybe that the ending in this one was a little too happy, you know, too convenient, but you know, we want to see people succeed. We want to see a guy with a positive attitude and a positive outlook be rewarded for that positive outlook.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's interesting to note that there really, you know, there are no villains in this film.
Yeah.
Right? There's no one hiding on the ship trying to leave Watney on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this sense of cooperation, too. You have the subplot with China, and they are willing to give part of their secret space program to the Americans. And it's just this spirit of cooperation. You have these crowds all watching and all rooting for him. And I think it says something about that. It also says something about the power of science, in that it's not just human spirit, right? But it's science that gets him home. And at the same time, it says that science is not cold, right? And a lot of times we think of science as kind of this cold field, but you look at it and these characters are using science to save one person because that one person matters. And that science is there for the people to bring about this benefit. And I think that that is a powerful view of science, in that sometimes science in films and even in our everyday lives can come across as something that's just sterile, something that's aloof. But this is an interesting look at how science and humanity are joined together. And if we look at it too from our Christian perspective, I think it shows us that we can kind of look at this world as just something that has come about by chance, and that as humans, the value we put on each other is just what we put on each other. But I think The Martian kind of points to something greater, in that science is good, but science is great when it acknowledges how each of us are valuable and how we can sacrifice for the individual, and that's good because everyone's valuable. And so I think that perspective in The Martian is just so well done.
So I'd probably push back a little bit, Wade, and say that I still feel like in this film, science is semi-neutral.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that science is depicted as a very positive tool. Unlike it would be like in an artificial intelligence, like an Ex Machina, you know, like what would happen if science kind of had its own conscience and could do something or had its own kind of motivations. But outside of that whole AI robot uprising type thing, I feel like science is a tool that's often seen as cold or often seen as harmful, or like too much science will only cause you pain. I feel like it's still a tool in this movie, but it could be a positive tool. But what the real impetus is that it takes something that's inherent in humanity to wield that tool properly.
Yeah, and it shows that the power of how science can be great is when we yield it to help other people.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I think you're definitely onto that. It's that there's this idea that science in films, like you mentioned, can be very cold and sterile and dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But you see science in its glorious beauty, something mm-hmm. that science can obtain to when we see it being used.
See science redeemed.
Yeah, to redeem it. We see it being used to value the individual and value the person, and I think that's something that's very powerful about this film, in that it represents a unique view of science, and I think a really important view of science.
Yeah, you used the word beauty, I think, a second ago, and I would say even beyond science, as in, you know, the process of discovery and solving problems, I think something easy to overlook in this film is the cinematography and the beauty. Like, you in some ways feel like you're seeing a new part of the universe for the mm-hmm. first time. And I think that's part of the kind of quiet respect that the audience has as they're sitting there just watching this person try to survive on Mars. I was really fascinated with what you said about there's no villains in this film. And I think typically you have the protagonist, the antagonist, and that's a major part of most storylines. So mm-hmm. what happens when you take that out? I would beg to differ a little bit. I do think there's a villain in this film, and I think the villain is death. At the very beginning of the movie, he goes through this litany of all the ways he can die. He says, I could do this, but then I could starve to death. I could do this, but then I would implode. I could do this, But then I would catch, then I would incinerate, and then there's a fourth when I could do this, and then I could suffocate. He goes through four. And so I think the antagonist is impersonal, which makes it a little, it makes it, in some ways, it makes it possible to be more lighthearted. It's harder to be lighthearted with a personal antagonist. Yeah, but an impersonal antagonist, it's like, well, what am I going to do? Like,
but it really is always looming and always chasing. It's what everyone's trying to avoid.
Yeah, it's what everybody's trying to avoid. So I would call death the antagonist.
Well, and I think that, there's definitely something there, because he does say, during an important scene in the film, he says, kind of relaying this message to his parents, he says, I'm dying for something big. If I die, I'm dying for something big and beautiful and something bigger than me. Mm-hmm. And death is kind of a part of that. But that discovery and exploration is something that can be powerful and beautiful. And if you look, you mentioned kind of the character of death. If you look at the character of Mars here, Mars is a character. Is that character bad or good? It's neutral. There are scenes when we'll see this environment and it looks incredibly dangerous. We'll see these dust whirls, these twister-like swirls in the distance. And then there are other moments when we'll look and Mars looks beautiful. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of dual nature to discovery and exploration is dangerous, but it can also be very beautiful. And if you compare that to something like maybe Prometheus or other science fiction films, often the terrain is only depicted as dangerous. But here, it kind of bleeds into that optimism in that you'll have some shots where Mars is a villain, but then you look in and you see it's also something beautiful and it's worth dying for, because exploration and kind of discovering this newness and this beauty is something that we should be working towards.
Yeah, that's a great point. He goes up on the hill at the end of every day at one point just to look at the beauty of the landscape. I think going back to the death piece for a second, the thing that I guess one of my biggest critiques, if I were to give it a critique, is he even tries to science death. Like, he analyzes all the four ways that he could die. It's very dispassionate how he goes about doing that. I could try this, but then I would die this way. And it feels like everything's being forced through the lens of science, where I kind of want to say, well,
like irreverent of death?
Not irreverent. It just doesn't feel like if certain death was like looming at your door, I'm not sure you would think scientifically about it.
Mm.
I feel like there would be something else that would come in there emotionally or psychologically that kind of and then he just says, I'm not going to die. And he goes on solving all the problems. So
it's a man living in denial until he comes up with a plan.
It's optimistic. I mean, the positive spin on it is it's optimistic. He's describing death. He recognizes it as a possibility, as the enemy or his antagonist. But then he goes about trying to conquer it. And so that would be an optimistic spin on it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. And there is this kind of dual nature to the film, and that death is something that we can kind of calculate and work through. You look at the terrain, and it can be good and bad. And then you listen to the score, and in parts it's this kind of techno-futuristic score. And so it's kind of very futuristic, and then there's the running joke with the disco, and it's kind of old-fashioned, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's kind of this back and forth.
Yeah.
And going back to Tucholsky's cinematography, you have these very wide shots,
mm-hmm.
and then you have these very close shots. Mm-hmm. And so there's kind of this dual nature of the future, of the past, of danger, of opportunity, and he's kind of there in the middle. And he's got a very optimistic look. And so he looks at the danger and he sees opportunity there. And I think it even says something about space exploration. You'll remember with Interstellar, there was this idea that once we stopped exploring and once we stopped inventing, the world started tanking, right? And so there's this idea that we shouldn't stop exploring here. We shouldn't be frightened by the danger. We should go forward and try to try to see all that creation has to offer. And that too gives a nice little angle to the film as well.
No, I think that's a great point. It's one of the things I wanted to mention, because there's this kind of quote from something I'll have in the show notes about how NASA was basically asked, like Ridley Scott asked NASA if they wanted to have a part in this. Mm-hmm. And NASA like didn't even hesitate. They were like, yes, please. Mm-hmm. And they said, The Martian is extremely recent science fiction. It's set in a version of the future that is not distant or fantastic, but familiar and possible. Mm-hmm. And the premise of the story is based on just the type of mission that NASA is planning. For this reason, above all others, NASA was over the moon. I like that kind of slip in there. About the Martian. Mm-hmm. And when I'm reading this, I remembered back to our Interstellar podcast. And I remember I praised Interstellar for critiquing a system that didn't fund NASA and other exploration programs. But I actually think the praise should probably be doted upon this film, because it not only showed a need for NASA, but I think it sparked some genuine curiosity about the possibilities of science and exploration, which I don't see as a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it did it in a way that we're all kind of agreeing, and based on what NASA's telling us, is, you know, familiar and possible, mm-hmm. not kind of theoretical, like we've already mentioned, kind of Interstellar gets to be at some point.
Yeah, several of the reviews described the moon generation, the generation that was alive when the mm-hmm. first moon landing happened, and they're now calling this the Mars generation. So people who kind of are shaped by this film and the dream, the aspiration of exploration to Mars. You like trivia, Mikey, so I was reading some trivia. Things that were in the movie that were actually scientifically incorrect because of the exploration of Mars is so current and so mm-hmm. ongoing. And two things they highlighted, one that they couldn't really help, they knew this was incorrect, is that gravity on Mars is 40% of gravity on Earth, so they actually would have been floating more.
Trivia, knew that one.
Did you know that there he actually would not have had to have make water on Mars?
Well, as of what? Just like
last week? As of Curiosity. The Curiosity that landed. And so this one guy said all he would have had to have done is gone out and get some dirt and heat it up, and he would have had plenty of water. Because there's like, I don't know, 75% water per cubic, some amount of cubic dirt. So that a major part of the movie, which was in the book, so it was just continuing what was in the book. Mm-hmm. And it was actually the author of the book that was saying this. After I finished the book, it goes to press and Curiosity lands. There's all this water on Mars that I didn't have to put that in the book. So that was too kind of... but yeah, I think that's to your point that this is pretty current research, current science, exploration, discovery that's going on. I think helps. In fact, there was a big headline that came out the day the movie came out. And the big headline was... glaciers discovered on Mars. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people thought that this was an intentional marketing kind of combo
going on. Oh, I'm sure NASA was probably doing everything they can to cash in mm-hmm. on this, because, you know, like our NASA budget diminishes every year. And it's one of those things that I keep pointing to Neil deGrasse Tyson. He keeps just saying, you know, if like we just did, you know, one penny, you know, of every dollar, 1% of our budget to mm-hmm. exploration, then NASA would be funded for like the next, you know, gazillion years. You know, he gives some actual estimated years, but, you know, just that's how little it would take. And for something that seems like it would be so terribly important. And I hope I'm part of the Mars generation. I want this 2020 mission. I want to be around. I want to be watching my TV. Yeah. That's how interested I am. I was never interested in botany until I watched Mark Watney say, man, it takes somebody who knows a lot about plants. Yeah. Fortunately, botanist, you know, like that.
The hero of the movie is a farmer, not a guy that shoots a gun at an alien.
That's right.
Yeah. And well, I think that you're kind of joking, but I think that is one of the things that brings success to this film, is that it's not trying to be this over bloated blockbuster. Right. And, mm-hmm. it, you know, you think about it, is there are moments when it really does kind of take its time. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like it needs to rush. It doesn't feel like it needs to have an explosion every 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. There are times when we'll go back to NASA and there'll just be kind of dialogue and they're trying to solve this problem. And we're sitting there and we're watching it. And then we go back to Mark Watney and it's like, well, we've been in Houston. We've been with NASA for a little while and we kind of forget about that. And it allows its story to kind of do its work. And it has very, very strong dialogue. And so, like you mentioned, it doesn't have to have a superhero or an action star. You've got a farmer who's quick-witted, who's has got ingenuity, and just kind of being able to make that work is a testament to, you know, the script and Scott, just Ridley Scott, just allowing the story to kind of to work on its own two feet.
I think you hit on something there that's easy to overlook, and I'll maybe pose it as a question. I think there's a huge motif or theme of two worlds going on. You've got the Mars world and the community that's up in space, and then you've got the NASA world and the world that's going on Earth, and the film intentionally cuts back and forth between those worlds. If there is a plot line, that's essentially the plot line. Here's what's going on in NASA, here's what's going on in space. Yeah. So the question I would ask is, how is Ridley Scott, the screenwriter, the actors, how are they characterizing the two worlds? And is there an intentional contrast in the characterization of the two worlds? I think there is, but I'll throw it out to you guys as a question.
Are you still thinking about it, Wade?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess to kind of work through that question, how does he build the characters within these worlds, or what kind of, I guess, maybe rephrase that question?
Yeah, more so the worlds themselves. I think Ridley Scott is giving a characterization to the space world, and I think he's giving a characterization to the Earth world, the NASA world. Mm-hmm. And I think the characterization that he's giving both worlds is in intentional contract. And so that's my working theory anyway. So I'm curious if y'all would agree with that. And if so, what do you think the contrast is and what's the purpose of that contrast?
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I mean, I mentioned a little bit before about how he, you know, Mars is definitely this character in of itself. You know, with NASA, everything is, he kind of works within this, you know, glossy type world, and it's run in a way by bureaucracy. And so it's very different. You have all these components kind of working together, and they're trying to figure out how to do this with everyone. And then you kind of have Watney, who is just kind of, for most of the film, just on his own in doing that. So I guess maybe that answers part of your question.
Yeah, no, I think bureaucracy is definitely one difference that comes to mind. PR is a big theme in the Earth world. Like, we can't let this get out. There's a lot more control and kind of manipulation going on in the Earth world.
Compared to Mark Watney, who's just saying whatever he wants to.
He's just cussing out the world on his computer screen. I think there's a unity in the Mars world with the spaceship that's coming back. Like, there's no debate or question about whether they're going back from Mars. Mm-hmm. Like, they're all in and they're all going back.
There's technically a vote, but it's
like, no, inconsequential. It's a done deal. And in Earth, you have a lot of division, a lot of disagreement. Somebody's getting fired. So he seems to me to present the Mars world and the people who are involved in the Mars world as more pure and more altruistic in some ways, more focused on just life and death, survival, more of a close-knit friendship. And then the Earth world seems more fractious, more image-focused, more PR-focused, more bureaucratic. So I'm intrigued by that contrast.
Well, so I'll ask you this, Elijah. I guess along the same train of thought, or at least I think it is, it seems like this movie has like a subtle call to abandon differences and grasp hold of things that connect us. In this case, we see people circumventing those political boundaries. They're circumventing that bureaucracy for this common cause.
They're committing mutiny.
They're committing mutiny. Yeah. So did you find that, because that goes a little bit against how you're saying they characterized the NASA piece or the back on planet Earth piece. That goes against kind of how you're describing that. So did you find them trying to do that? Did that come off maybe a little too idealistic? Or does it basically just show that there's a true need for interdependency among humanity?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm kind of going to answer your question with maybe a rhetorical question.
Well, I'll answer your rhetorical question.
We're going to have a ping pong rhetorical question match. Now, here's the question I wrestle with. To what extent should The Martian be viewed as a dystopian movie?
And I would say it's not, because there is this bureaucracy and there are these factions that do care about PR, but I mean ultimately they're working together. China, and this is an important scene, China has an opportunity to not offer any help and no one would know about it.
Yeah.
Right.
And the film almost teeters on unrealistic because you wonder if that would ever happen. Mm-hmm. But it shows a future that's bright. And that's part of what I think can make – makes the Star Trek universe just very fascinating, is it's not this dystopian future setting. It's kind of this bright there's more to explore. And so I would say it's a very – optimistic, saying, hey, like, wouldn't it be beautiful if we all rallied around this common cause to bring one man home? Look at how great this would be.
You don't think that's too idealistic?
Well, hold on. Let me make my case for how I think this is dystopian.
Okay.
Indirectly so. So I would agree with everything you said, Wade, and I would add on top of what you said, the global celebration of one man coming home. So the nations of the earth now celebrate in the public square when Mark Watney comes back to Earth. So totally this kind of world peace, let's all hold hands, let's all celebrate together, which is the celebration over one man who comes home. You start getting into prodigal son themes here, which is kind of interesting.
And then he just goes and trains people to do it again. He's not super famous.
What did the prodigal son do after he came home, right? Yeah. So, but here's where I think it's dystopian, and it's actually not on the screen. So if you start looking at the interviews that Matt Damon and Ridley Scott and the people who are really care a lot about science did, the way they promoted this film. So this is almost a verbatim quote from Matt Damon. He said, so what's your takeaway from this, Matt? The interviewer says, we need to dramatically increase NASA's budget because we are only one extinction level event away from needing another planet. And so I think a lot of the drive. So here's my working theory to answer Mikey's question, like what's going on in this film, political dynamics, all that. I think space exploration uniquely cuts across the grain of right and left and unites them because it gives the left that cares a lot about sustainability, environmental care, are we destroying the world, global warming, all this stuff. It gives them, like, we need to pursue this because we need kind of a backup plan for when for when we destroy Earth. And it gives the more right side of the political spectrum this kind of gung-ho, we can do this, we can conquer, we can explore and be the master of our own fate. But so what's fascinating to me on the dystopian question is that the actors and some of the people involved in the film themselves think we need to do this because Earth is going to become a dystopia. And they think Mars is going to be our salvation.
Yeah.
And what to me I think is just very intriguing is this idea of the Earth about to be destroyed doesn't make its way in the movie at all. And so
there's
this idea, you know, maybe these things are rolling around, but I like that it didn't make its way.
And
I think I do think that's really interesting in that maybe he's mixing. Maybe they're mixing opinions with this artwork, but I don't see the art, you know, promoting. I think it is promoting exploration and how that can be beautiful. But I guess maybe that it kind of loses me on the world is about to go extinct thread.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It didn't make it in the movie, but if you look at headlines now, such and such list of billionaires now have their place reserved for the first colony on the moon. Such as just the billionaires have already signed up for their spot on Mars. And so for me, that's where it starts to get into when you start tying it back into culture and how the culture is seeing space exploration. That's where I start getting into issues of humanity and issues of human nature. So here's how I would put it. I wrote it down that fascinates me. It's ironic to me that science can solve the problem of survival on Mars, but by implication, again, this is a comment on the broader culture as it ties into the movie, but can't figure out how to solve the problems on Earth.
Mm. That's actually, I would be remiss to say that I would be quoting him,
mm-hmm.
but it's a critique that Neil deGrasse Tyson had of Interstellar.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and he's like, if all the time and effort put into colonizing a world through, you know, the wormhole in Interstellar mm-hmm. was put into fixing Earth,
mm-hmm.
it would have been infinitely easier.
And so here would be my corollary to Neil, I forget his whole name, but
deGrasse
Tyson. I'm going to be provocative in saying this. Part of what was so beautiful about Mars was that there was only one person on it.
Yeah.
Right? So what we're really talking about is not so much the science of a planet. What we're really talking about is the reality of human nature. And science, as good and strong as it was in The Martian, can't do for the whole human population what, at least in the movie, it was able to do for Mark Watney.
So I think that is loosely related, and I'm not just using that for a segue, because I think it's going to hit on this last piece that I want to make sure we talk about, and that is the power of story. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. I think story is powerful. Obviously, here at Real World Theology, we think story is powerful. We say it, or I say it every time, unless someone jumps in there and says it for me. But I saw this really, I wouldn't say hilarious, but this really amusing meme on Facebook the other day. And it said, between Saving Private Ryan, Interstellar, and The Martian, the American government has spent an excessive amount of money and resources to bring Matt Damon home. You know?
Yeah.
And in each of those situations, why do we think that it's possible that we would spend that amount of resources, you know, that time, that effort, and so many people are willing to sacrifice their life to bring one person home from Mars, when we see every day that we wouldn't spend, like, you know, three of us wouldn't spend a couple dollars to save one person from something terrible like sex mm-hmm. slavery. I don't want to make this like whatever it is, like inflammatory or anything, but mm-hmm. like you know, someone who's homeless or someone who can't pay their bills. Like, we wouldn't even go that far for a person. And I would say that is indicative of the power of story, because there's something powerful about adding a story to a situation. I think it humanizes it and gets people behind it. And I think that's what mm-hmm. most nonprofits try to do now. They're not like, hey, we mm-hmm. all agree that helping the homeless is good, mm-hmm. so give us money and blankets. They're not just like, hey, we think it's great to stop people from doing bad things, or that people in Africa can have clean water. We think everyone's cool with that. Like, that doesn't work anymore. People have to say, this is so-and-so. She has to walk 20 miles to get clean water in this bucket. You know, like, see her, understand her story, and then people will help.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I said, to me, it speaks to our natural need or inclination for not understanding things unless they're putting, like, facts are facts, but facts don't move us.
Mm-hmm.
Story moves us. I think we're, because of us being made in the Imago Dei, we are built for story to move us. It's why Jesus taught it. You know, he didn't say the kingdom is 20 miles wide, and, you know, he didn't give a list of facts about the kingdom. He told stories mm-hmm. and parables about the kingdom
mm-hmm.
Because those would move us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think part of, I mean, this is a movie, obviously, so would NASA really have done this if this had really happened? Or would some bureaucrat have said, no, that's going to cost too much and it won't work, so we're leaving him behind? But I do think that part of what's appealing about this story, and that gives it a sense of legitimacy and that it's not completely made up or completely unrealistic, is the novelty of the novelty of the rescue mission, the novelty and the complexity of the rescue mission. So can we do this thing that we've never done before, swing ourselves around Mars, pick somebody up in midair and, like, bring them back home? And, wow, that's kind of cool. Wouldn't that be awesome that we could do it? But after you've seen somebody asking for money on the street corner for the 421st time.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of lost its... It's like, oh, the first time, who's that, mommy or daddy? Oh, that's what they're doing. And so you kind of get used to it. You kind of stew in your juices, so to speak. And I think that's part of the challenge of the story of the prodigal son, which is that there's only one person who's really longing for this rebellious kind of thieving, asked for his dad's money early son mm-hmm. to come home, and it's the father. The brother can't stand the idea of him coming home, doesn't want him to come home, and in fact renounces him by calling him this son of yours. He's not even my brother anymore. This son of yours wasted all your money, and now you're going to throw him a party. So I do think the heart of God is to welcome people home, but I think in our human heart, we oftentimes militate against that because it's too hard, it's too uncomfortable, they don't deserve to come home, or I want to hang out with people like me, and that person coming home is going to kind of rock the boat a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, in that sense, I do think it's a redemptive movie, or at least has redemptive themes, particularly the theme of celebration at coming home.
Hmm. Yeah. And I think that is, I think the celebration of someone coming home, it's a little bit different because I think the idea of innocence goes a long way. And Mark Watney's character is in that position, not because he made an immoral mistake.
He didn't steal a spaceship and
get
shut down on Mars.
I think the important thing to note in this story is the idea of innocence and the idea of empathy. And in Watney's story, it's easy to see him as an innocent person, and it's easy to be empathetic, meaning we can kind of put ourselves in our shoes. So to kind of go back to your question, Fizz, is that I think the reason why we don't do that is because we can look at people and say, well, they should have done this, or if I were in their situation. And so we lose that idea of that person being innocent. And maybe that person isn't, but we don't offer grace. So I think that's an important thing. And then also empathy, not really knowing their stories, kind of like what you talked about. And so I think that kind of plays into the question that you're asking about the power of story and the mm-hmm. power of the value of individual.
Cool. So I want to kind of push us towards wrapping up, but we'll still have a chance for final thoughts right at the very end, because we're getting about that time in the show. So we've all mentioned that, we enjoy this film to some degree, probably some of us more than others. I'm basically assuming that since I liked it so much, Elijah liked it less.
Because I'm an iconoclast.
No,
I liked it. I'm going to agree with you and Mikey on this one, Mikey. It was cool.
So, but we still, any sci-fi movie, no matter how good it is, I can almost always find something that kind of is an annoyance. But Wade, what would be your, come on moment or your thing that kind of irked you about the movie?
Yeah, no. So I was talking about this on my podcast with my co-host Kevin. And I talked about how in the book it can be very technical at times, and I felt like they did a good job of not making the film too technical. The one thing that kind of irked me a bit is this continual reliance on these object lessons. And I'm cool with that, right? I'm cool with like an Interstellar, they fold the piece of paper together and they punch a hole through it to talk about wormholes. Like, I'm okay, but I felt like there were multiple times when it was these object lessons. Hey, let's take a salt shaker and a pepper shaker and let me show you how it works. Or here, this pen represents the Aries, this and that. And so mm-hmm. I was just like, okay, like, we understand, right? And it's as if they were really talking to each other in real life, would they be using these obvious object lessons with salt shakers, with pens? I don't know. So that was one of the things that was like, oh, okay, come on.
All right, Elijah.
Yeah, I had two come on moments related to the same thing. I mean, I'm a pastor, so I kind of pay attention to spiritual or religious themes in the movie. So they had two, quote, religion lines in the movie. One is when he's whittling the crucifix mm-hmm. and to make fire, and he kind of looks down at Jesus down on the cross and says, I hope you got my back there, buddy, or I hope you're on my side, buddy. And then there's another scene down on Earth with NASA, and one guy turns to Chiwetel Ejiofor, I never can say his name right, and says, do you believe in God? And he says, yeah, I believe in several, but my my mom was a Baptist and my dad was a Hindu or something like that.
Yeah.
And so it felt like the obligatory, we're out in space, we're kind of in God's territory, so we got to say something about God and hope that he's on our side. So it just didn't feel like it was part of the movie, but they were kind of trying to make it part of the movie just through the small talk, I guess.
Wait, did you read the book?
Yes.
So from, I preface that with, you can correct me if I'm wrong, or probably when I'm wrong, which rarely happens. But I'm under the impression that in the book, Mark Watney is pretty vocally atheist and, you know, high on science is like the way, the movie to some degree plays, but he almost makes fun of religion in the book to some degree.
You know, I think there might have been a couple of jokes, but it wasn't this antagonistic.
Yeah.
Maybe a few jokes, but the crucifix scene is there. I believe the line with my father was a Baptist preacher, I think that's there as well. I think maybe there were a couple of jokes, but I don't think it wasn't anything. I was like, oh, he's very antagonistic,
like mean-spirited kind of.
Yeah. I don't remember that. Maybe I just forgot, but
you used to enjoy the book so much you forgot. I think because one of the reviews I read said that they seem to play down his atheism for the movie and, you know, version.
Hmm.
I guess to be more palatable to general audiences.
Hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, it didn't stick out to me as much. But I don't remember anything very antagonistic.
Well, in this conversation, you're the expert, so if you say it, we believe it.
Well, hopefully I didn't just forget or something like that.
Okay, so for my part, I love Donald Glover. Except for the fact that he decided to do music instead of continuing to do Community. That still hurts a little bit. But I almost like him playing his Donald Glover character of a wide-eyed Donald Glover. But even in a movie with characters who were kind of one-note, one-reason characters, he still seemed a little too out there.
I liked his character. I thought it was fun.
Well, like I said, it was weird. I enjoyed watching him do it, but it just felt like it didn't quite fit for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really know how to explain that well. So that was like my come on light. So, but my real moment where I sat there and I said, I looked at my wife in the middle of the movie and she looked over at me about the same time and she just like mouthed, come on, was when Chris Beck or, you know, the Winter Soldier, Sebastian Stan was jaunting about the space station with no like attachment cable. I'm like, do they just not use attachment cables when you're out in the middle of space? Nowhere can come get you. Like, this doesn't make any sense. And like the first thing Jessica Chastain's character does before she goes out, she's like, I'm tethering up. I'm like, I don't understand. Like, I know he's got to go around the outside. There's got to be some way to tether yourself in. It felt like unneeded. Like, is he going to catch it? Is he going to catch on? Like, who does that? Like, that's not like Evel Knievel kind of, that's just stupid. Like, that's dumb.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I was just like, come on. Like, he's got to know, I was like, there's got to be something. They've put in those suits, like a real attractable something he can put on and jump and then release. I don't know. Anyway. So, obviously, I'm still getting worked up about it. So, it's definitely my come on moment. All right. But we hopefully end on a positive note. So, Wade, your favorite thing about The Martian?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say, you know, what is my favorite thing. We've talked about Matt Damon's performance. Really, all the characters and actors did well. And so that was just a lot of great things. I think one of the things I really enjoyed was this was a movie I felt like for nerds. And you could be content being a nerd, and there are these little jokes. And the best one is the reference to Elrond, the Lord of the Rings council. Right. And and so that joke, and then the fact that Sean Bean is sitting there in the room when they make the joke, and he, you know, he was of course in Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, and so just kind of the nerd factor. It just felt like a film for nerds. You trying to figure something out and do this, and the hero is not this guy with a gun. You know, he's a smart guy, and I think the nerd factor is probably one of my favorite parts.
I think that is completely fair. Not that I would have to agree with you for it to be your favorite moment, but.
Yeah, I think for me, I'm going to go a little bit meta here.
Brace yourself.
And no, I'm gonna ask another rhetorical question. I'm just in a questioning mood tonight. But for me, the question would be, why are we seeing a resurgence of space movies? So I think it's cool that we are seeing a resurgence of space movies, but I'm not exactly sure why. And obviously, I'm referring to Gravity, Interstellar, and now this. So I think the thing that I liked best was the fact that somebody made a really good space movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to figure out what they're tapping into culturally that is making production studios as well as audiences want to make and then go see well-done space movies. Is it that we're like kind of on the verge of a more exploratory spirit again as a nation? Is that what's going on? Or should we like feeling small and seeing something bigger than ourselves? Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is, but I just like the fact that there was a well-done space movie
mm-hmm.
that a lot of people want to see.
Well, I hope it's that we're interested in space exploration again.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. Mm-hmm. I'm crossing my fingers for that one, even though crossing my fingers will do nothing.
What's the science of crossing your fingers, Mikey?
I wonder if I would probably have more hope in science of crossing my fingers than the theology of crossing my fingers.
Like maybe your blood would flow differently if you crossed your finger.
It's like one of those rocks that like emits some kind of low harmonic or something.
Yeah.
Like something about the weight blood ratio mm-hmm. to your fingers. Unhinges pieces of your brain that slowly allow you to be more optimistic.
Yeah.
I don't know. Or susceptible because you're basically hoping for luck.
Uh-huh.
So,
the placebo effect.
Exactly.
Right.
Let's see. So I think kind of like both you guys picking like an individual part of this movie that I like was my favorite isn't really easy. I would say that there are a couple scenes that I remember more than others. But not necessarily because they were my favorite scenes, but I think because it points to an overarching idea that is probably my favorite. And it's something that I hinted at the beginning, and it's the fact that this movie allows itself to be kind of like optimistic and full of humor while still maintaining some level of gravity, you know? So in general, Mark Watney's humor and consistency of that humor, and that's really important.
Yeah.
The consistency of that humor is what really did it for me because it does a couple things. It helps make certain things, I think, pay off better later in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And an example of that would be, like I said, a scene that sticks with me when he has that conversation with himself or the camera, you know, about the appeal of being the fastest man ever in space. And he's like, well, you think that's just going to appeal to me? Like, that doesn't sound great. It kind of does sound great, you know, but he's been funny through the whole movie. So it's not odd that he's having this really mm-hmm. kind of hilarious conversation with him.
Yeah.
And we've known enough about his personality that it does make sense that he would allow himself to be convinced by something as like the bravado of being the, you know, the fastest man ever in space. But what it also does is it means that when he is not being humorous, it's important.
That's mm-hmm. a good point.
And if done right, it wouldn't be false introspection mm-hmm. or, you know, feigning philosophical. But if you capture a moment where he's not being humorous, it could be beautiful. And I think it was because I seriously did get, like, I won't say I got choked up or anything, but I felt it hit me when he's sitting there on the launch pad getting ready to leave Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not smiling. He just has a moment mm-hmm. where, like, he is so, like it's all paid off. And he doesn't have anything funny to say. You know, there's nothing smart, no witty thing. You can just see Matt Damon conveying gratitude mm-hmm. In a very honest way. And I think that pays off because you have the guy who doesn't shut up at just the right moment.
Yeah, I think you make a good point there. And I fast forward a couple of minutes later to the scene where he says, I'm going to pull an Iron Man. Like the life or death moment, to your point, he's done such a good job of interweaving humor with his character mm-hmm. development. That you don't think that's ridiculous for him to say, I'm going to pull an Iron Man and cut my suit open at the hand so I can
mm-hmm.
thrust myself up to Jessica Chastain so I can get caught. I like the consistency of humor, which is kind of the opposite of my point about the religious comments. Like, where'd that come from? That wasn't part of the character development. Mm-hmm. It just felt like an add-on.
Well, I want to, I guess, open it up one last time for any final thoughts. Wade, is there anything that you wanted to add or say about this movie before we kind of start winding it down?
You know, I really enjoyed it. I think it's got a it's a good mixture of patience, but also it has enough to bring in general audiences. So it's really a winner, I feel like, on both sides. And mm-hmm. And I encourage people to check it out. It's a fun fall film, and I think it's something too that husbands and wives can enjoy together. And so mm-hmm. with space films, that might not always be the case. My wife loved it, so yeah, I know I really liked it. A couple things here and there that maybe I didn't with intensity and this and that, but overall, I thought it was a fantastic film.
Awesome, Elijah. Any kind of things you want to make sure you get out there?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Thought it was a great film. The biggest film I found myself contrasting this film to was the movie Castaway,
mm-hmm.
where you have Tom Hanks stuck on an island and Wilson becomes his conversation partner, best friend, helper, all of the above. Wilson being a little volleyball that floats to him in the ocean, or that he somehow finds there on the island. And so I think that contrasted pretty directly with the screens around Mark Watney.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always interacting, almost always interacting with something, a screen around him, which created a different feel as the audience, like you're being directly talked to by Mark Watney mm-hmm. on the screen. I also think in a subtle kind of way, maybe not even intentional, it fit well with the selfie generation, where you're always being looked at by your own camera, and yeah. you're always talking to your own camera and posing for your own camera. But it was a selfie about survival, so it was a little less superficial than kind of teeny bopper selfie that you sometimes think of. So yeah, I think the camera, we didn't hit on it much, but I think the surround sound cameras or the surround visual cameras and his interaction with those cameras created an interesting character and relationship and dialogue development mechanism that really helped carry the movie in a lot of ways.
Well, and I think that hits on something too that I want to mention hopefully just really quickly. And it's another piece of consistency that I see in this film. And him talking to the camera would seem like an easy scapegoat for him explaining things to us that we wouldn't yeah. understand.
Which he was doing.
which is exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
But he was doing it in a fun and yeah. cheeky kind of way
yeah.
that kind of made sense because he's all about science. So consistently, yeah. he's going to want to document everything.
Yeah.
Hopefully someone's going to, even if he dies for this cause that he knows is bigger than himself, he hopes that someone will come, find these records, know how he, you know, grew something on Mars and, you know, haha, I got the last left. I colonized Mars because I planted plants or whatever. I think it pays off not only because, like I said, we see the consistency in the character and in the storytelling, but that consistency is there when he leaves the rover behind. And he leaves that note in it, like mm-hmm. yeah. whoever finds this, like treat her well, she saved my life, or basically, you know, like who knows who's gonna find that, but he's basically documenting that, you know, like he was there. That served a purpose. It meant something, you know, it just consistency. And I really, like I said, I really liked that,
mm-hmm.
That mm-hmm. it was just true throughout. So,
yeah.
Well, with that, I guess we'll close up shop admitting that this movie was a lot of fun that I think people should probably go see it, you know, a little mild language stuff like that. If you're interested in science, go see it. If you're interested in exploration, go see it. Sci-fi. I think, you know, you can, most adults will enjoy the film of any demographic. So, it has not let us down. It's kind of like that, like I said, that flag that I was talking about earlier, the kickoff to, you know, October and later, the October to, you know, first 2 weeks of January kind of thing. I feel like we got started well, and I hope this continues.
Yeah.
So, but we didn't talk about everything. I'm sure there's things we missed. I know I've had conversations with my wife that, we did not hit on. And so if there's anything else, make sure that, you're keeping those conversations going. And if you'd like to specifically keep those conversations going with Elijah or Wade, I hope now they will let us know how to do that. So Wade, how can people follow the things that you're doing and maybe even get in contact with you to tell you how much they loved hearing you on The Martian?
Oh man, I would love that. You can follow me on Twitter at Wade Hance. And also I really like Letterboxd, and you can search for me. I think it's letterboxd.com/WadeHance, Hance, and so yeah, do that and connect with me. I also have a podcast. It's called Seeing and Believing, and it's a weekly podcast. We are a little bit different. We don't get into a lot of spoilers, but we do talk about movie and television, and so movies and television. So I would encourage you to check that out. It's on iTunes. But other than that, yeah, I'd love to connect and talk more about the film or just film in general.
Yeah, awesome.
You can connect with me primarily through Church of the Redeemer. That's my full time job. I'm an Anglican priest at Church of the Redeemer. You can visit our website if you want to listen to some sermons and thoughts.
Maybe not right now.
Have on there. Mikey's our pod. Yeah, Mikey's sabotaged our service, so he's uploading those. But once he's fixed them, or somebody's fixed them, www.redeemergso.org. And my email address that you can also contact me at is Elijah@redeemergso. And I'm happy to entertain any questions or hear any ideas you have. I love thinking and talking and conversating with people about this stuff.
We got to get you back on Twitter. I mean, I know you're technically there, but you're not really there.
Yeah, I didn't have enough time or bandwidth or whatever. Yeah. I'm a late adapter.
Yeah, you are.
I'm a very late adapter.
Elijah's still printing copies of everything. I'm still trying to get him electronic, but you know, he's good at what he does, so it's hard to really convince him to do something different. So you can follow me, if you would like, at Fizzification on Twitter. You can also follow the show at Real World Theo. Please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you've enjoyed it. You can do that on iTunes, Stitcher. We have a feed burner feed. And we are so grateful for, as always, our excellent guests. So please, I'm just going to beg you to do lots of things right here, Dan. Follow them on social media, even though you can't follow Elijah really on social media, unless you can stalk him on Facebook. I encourage stalking Elijah on Facebook. You'll find some interesting conversations. Find them on social media, follow them where they post their podcasts, their written content, their letterbox, anything on the web. And in the meantime, we are very, very thankful to you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Oh, wow.
So I've been up for a very long time.
So if you fall asleep in the podcast, you want me to just carry this for you?
Well, as soon as, I mean, I expect you to carry it anyway, Elijah. That's why you're here. That's why I brought in the big guns.
Yeah.
Yes.